Welcome to Meeple, uniting players around the world. A 30-minute exploration of PJ and Gareth's four-game experiences from across both sides of the Atlantic. Each episode, they share their thoughts and opinions on the world of board games, including their favourite themes, games, hot topics, and much, much more.
Hey, and welcome to episode 59. And today is a battle of wits. A two-player battle of wits. Each episode is usually two-player, but not always a battle of wits. But today is a little bit different. As always, I'm PJ.
And I'm Gareth.
And we have a very special guest with us today. We have the designer, the creator, the man, the brain behind the upcoming game, Kelp. Carl Robinson, how are you, Carl?
I am really good, guys. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm a fan of the podcast, and I'm happy to be here and talk to you.
Oh, thank you. And welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
So for anyone who's not listening, who hasn't seen, I think seen Kelp popping up on the socials for the last maybe 4 to 6 weeks. Do you want to give everyone introduce yourself, Carl, and then a bit about what Kelp is all about?
Sure, yeah. I'm Carl, and I'm a relatively new board game designer. I will be once this Kelp comes out, although I've been kind of tinkering around with designs for years now, actually, since I got into the hobby back in 2012, 2013. So I'm originally from the northwest of England, but Ray. I moved to... Yay! people probably hear that in my accent at certain times, although I've lived in Belgium for coming up on 12 years now. And it was as I moved to Belgium, actually, with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, that that's when I kind of fell back into the hobby with the passion, and pretty immediately started wanting to tinker around with games and try making stuff, and made a few expansions to games, my favorite kind of things, and I made some ghosts for Werewolf that works pretty well, actually. And my cool. I teach Werewolf with my I don't teach it I teach drama, but I use Werewolf at the end of semester often, and having a set of Werewolf ghosts is pretty handy too, when as players get eliminated they keep playing and stuff like that. And then just in 2020, I saw the documentary My Octopus Teacher.
Yep.
I don't know if either of you seen that documentary.
Yeah.
For anybody who hasn't seen the documentary, that it's important because this is kind of the starting point for Kelp. There's this, basically, in short, a diver goes and films an octopus for every day for a year or for this octopus's life. And while filming it, he captures some incredible behavior because the octopus is being hunted by a pajama shark, which is the one of the characters in the game. And it's exposed one day, the octopus. It's got nowhere to hide. And this shark is circling it and going round and round. And it's clear that bad things are on the horizon.
Yeah. So,
the octopus has this incredible way of escaping in that it rolls itself up into a ball of shells. It sticks shells to all its tentacles and makes this ball of armor around it, and then lets go of the shells while the shark's eating them and swims off in the other direction, leaving the shark dumbfounded, confused, eating shells. Absolutely incredible. And I saw that moment and it was so playful, so ludic, and so creative from the octopus, that I sort of immediately had this idea for a game. And so that's what Kelp became. So Kelp is a two-player, deeply asymmetric game where one player plays an octopus and they're playing a little bit of a deck-building, hand-management game, moving around kind of like Stratego blocks, Stratego pieces almost, that only they can see, the octopus player can mm-hmm. see. They're little Mahjong tiles with one of them has the octopus printed on them. And so they're trying to keep that octopus hidden and away from the shark. And meanwhile, the shark is playing a dice pool building game and they're swimming around the blocks, rolling dice, using special abilities to mitigate the look, trying to reveal the octopus's blocks, find out where they're hiding, and then beat them in this final confrontation. And so, yeah, that's the sort of the quick elevator pitch for the game, if you like.
I'm sold. I'm a huge fan of kind of two-player abstracty, I guess, kind of battle of wits between the two, which is, I mean, that's the title I see is written in Board Game Geeper's description. Yeah. I know I haven't played, and PJ, you played at Gen Con.
Yes.
I've read the rule book, so I've got my own views, but how did you find the game?
Oh my gosh. This is the most brilliant design of a board game that I've experienced in my almost 20 years of gaming. And you can quote me on that.
Wow. Thank you.
It was, putting aside my and my wife's affinity for two-player games, which was the natural draw when we were in the first exposure playtest hall at Gen Con, and we're like, oh, let's go check out this two-player game. We sat down, and they are describing it similar to what you did. And we're like, wait, so I'm playing a dice bag builder, and she's playing a deck builder. So our mechanics are completely asymmetrical. And then our gameplay is completely asymmetrical. I will say, however, that I did terribly as a shark. you know, when your first roll is all ones, you can pretty much take it to the bank. You're not finding anything. So I didn't do very well, but I still got to enjoy and experience the mechanics.
Sure.
Meanwhile, my wife, aside from the fact that as the octopus she won, she got to like just experience all the cards that were available to her as she was evading my attempts to locate her and put obstacles in my way. And it was just really incredible. The mechanics were, Gareth, you have no idea. When you get a copy, I want to play this game with you. That's what we're going to do when we first meet up.
If I could set up Steam and I could have a go, but
I know.
No, I read the rule book and I've watched, there's like a 12-minute video like introducing the game that Carl's produced. But I read through it and went, I love the fact that there's two completely different mechanics and I'm doing that hide and seek and hunt and destroy or, you know, attack. I can just see that battle of wits again, trying to get the balance between the two. So Carl, how do you win the game? So if I'm the shark, what's my mission?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the shark, if you're playing as a shark, your mission is to locate the octopus and beat them in what we call the final confrontation. So I could talk a little bit more about that in a second, but I'll just circle back to what the octopus is doing. Meanwhile, the octopus has got two different ways to win, actually. They can survive until the end of the game, i.e. they outlive the shark, and the shark unfortunately starves, and they can beat them that way, or they can sort of shoot the moon and they can eat all of their food. And that also is tricky to do, because every piece of food they try and eat, they have to reveal themselves. So the octopus kind of comes out of hiding, snaffles up a crab or a bit of lobster, and then has to disappear away. And they get a special ability when they do that, but they comes at some risk. So the shark, they are, as I said, rolling dice and placing them on the board, and they have red dice that are rare. And every time they use a red dice, that also exhausts them. It goes on their hunger track, and so it ticks down to the end of the game. But if they can find the octopus, or if they can deduce where they're hiding, then they can get next to it and put a red die there and attack it. And that doesn't mean the octopus is it's game over, because in the documentary, actually, this is interesting, a little bit of a spoiler for anybody who's not seen the documentary. Early on, actually, the octopus does get caught by the shark in a different encounter. And it looks like it's over for this poor little octopus. It's being properly chomped on. And what it does is it sticks its tentacles, well, its arms, I should say, into the gills of the shark and suffocates it. And then the shark can't breathe, so it lets go of the octopus, and the octopus just swims off and carries on living. And so the game simulates that moment. And not only is it just about simulating that moment, it really ramps up the tension. So when the octopus gets revealed with a strike dice and attack dice, both players draw these three cards. They're called the confrontation cards. They're the escape strategies of the octopus. So the octopus has fight, flight, or flinch. It can stick its arms in the tentacles of the shark. It can use a cloud of ink and disappear away, or it can lose one of its tentacles, because octopuses can actually regrow tentacles. And so they play one of those cards face down in secret, and the shark tries to guess what their escape is going to be and counter that with a matching counter. And if the shark plays it right, they win immediately. But there's a 33% chance of that, and they're not always equal as well, depending on the circumstances. The special effects are going to vary. So it's this mind game as you try to work out what the other's going to do. In fact, I learned an interesting term on that. Have either of you heard Wifum?
No.
Wifum. It's a term from, it was on the Board Game Co. review of Kelp recently. He talked about it, and it's the first time I heard of it. Wifum is from The Princess Bride.
Right.
And it's a term which means the wine in front of me. And will I drink the wine in front of me?
Oh, yeah. I remember the scene, and that's a really good description of the playing of those cards. Yeah.
It's this idea that you're facing your enemy, and there's two cups on the table, their cup and your cup, and you're given the choice. Do you switch cups or do you drink your own? Okay. One of them has poison in it.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of that term is actually really, I'm really glad I know it now, because that's what it is at the end of the game. It's which will you play the best card? But I know you might play the best card. So will you play the weakest card? Yeah. And you've got to outthink each
genius.
Other.
But with each encounter, if I recall, you discard them. So if you're the shark and you fail the first attempt, and even the second attempt, then you'll definitely succeed in the third attempt because the cards that you use are discarded.
Yeah, okay.
That is exactly what happened to me. Yeah.
The strategy of the octopus, whichever escape strategy they use, the shark learns that escape, and so it's no longer usable. And so the next time it's 50-50, and the third time they catch him, it's 100%.
Yep.
But you've got to be able to do that before the game ends. If you've got to catch him three times before the game ends. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've got to say that you can feel the tension just talking through it. That whole, the three cards in front of you, what do I play? And I love that idea of don't I play, the worst card to try and, I guess, trying to fool them. So you started designing a game in 2020. How's that design process been, I guess, as a first designer? And also, I guess, what's the iterations of the game been over the last 3 years?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, when I started out, I pretty quickly got the idea for how the shark was going to work. It was inspired by a mechanism from a game called Spirium that came out from Astari a few years ago. It didn't really get much buzz, but the cool thing about about Spirium was you were placing your workers, it was a worker placement game, at the intersections between cards. So you could place them on these kind of corridors between cards. And I got that idea from there for placing dice between these zones that the octopus was in. I started out actually trying to build a hand builder game. I had this idea where the octopus had four hands of cards laid out on the board face down. So 16 cards with one card in the center.
Yeah.
And that one of those cards would have an octopus written on it. And you were trying to keep that hard card hidden by flipping other cards and then improving each of those four hands. But it was a nice idea, except for one major flaw. It was incredibly hard to track 16 face down cards.
I can imagine. Oh. Yeah.
And remember, where did I put the octopus again? I've got to look at this. I've got to look at five cards just to check. You don't know which one the octopus is. So I tried that with my mum and dad and a few friends for a while, and there was some interesting facets to it, but ultimately there was too much memory. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until a few months later where I play tested it with a friend of mine, and he said, "Have you tried using tokens instead of cards?" And when he said that, I thought, not tokens, but blocks, if it was Stratego blocks. And then I put all the information onto cards that you played as a deck builder, then it would work. And I simplified it down into nine blocks, not 17.
Yeah.
And the moment that happened, the game was there and it worked. But I've learned since this like 3 year process, I learned pretty fast that there's this joke in board game design that people say, I think I've got about 80% of my game done. And then other designers will say, congratulations, you've got about 80% left to go. Because, I really did. I really had the core engine of the game working within two or three months of that first version. but then it was a case of balancing and streamlining for the next, really for the next 3 years. And it was a case of, you know, tweaking numbers and changing the abilities and wording, but also streamlining some of the systems to make it, just to make it resonate and make sense. And I think what I've been told is one of the biggest selling points of Kelp is that the teach isn't that big for an asymmetric game. It really does take about 10 minutes. The overview video covers pretty much everything, and that's an 11-minute video. And for an asymmetric game, that's quite good. So we've managed to streamline the rules down quite well, I think.
Certainly, I'd agree, because when I opened that rule book, I think it was like 20-ish something pages, and I was like, ooh, it's asymmetric. This is going to be a bit of a... Because I haven't got the game in front of me, it's a bit harder when you're trying to learn it. But actually, I went through rule book in about 15 minutes and went, actually, I think I could teach this relatively easily, because while it's asymmetric, actually both sets of rules are generally two or three actions, and then you're done. It's the, I guess it's just it's just a battle. It's a strategic bit of how do I make sure that I survive or I win.
Yeah, and there's, I think a lot of what the rulebook is illustrations, a lot of pictures showing you how movement works. But movement, once you get the idea of how the shark moves around, it's thematic, and it makes sense that they're swimming with it down the flow of water and things like that. And that was something really important to me, to try and make it feel thematic, because that sells a lot of the rules and it helps you pick them up faster.
Yeah, I'm a real stickler, I guess, for the rulebook. And actually, thinking about it now, the way it was flowed with the illustrations and the explanations made an excellent rule book. I didn't have to go back and address anything. It was actually very, very good. What's been the biggest change to rules? Was it just that piece around going from the cards, or is the game now done, I guess? Happy with it?
Yeah. It certainly stayed stable, very, very stable for a while. We've tested it over 200 times now, and it really has, balance wise, it's been very balanced for quite some time. But one of the late changes, so I pitched the game at Essen last year. That's where I found Wonderbowl, who are publishing the game, and I pitched it to them, and they were interested pretty quickly when I explained it to them. And in those next few weeks, as they came on board, we started to do a little bit more streamlining and got some really good feedback at Essen as well. Cause I took it, I got a play tester table. I got a table in the proto zone, and it was play tested I want to say like 40 or 50 times just in the proto zone. We were busy the entire time, demoing it to people. And, the way that the shark moved, there was this kind of artificial restriction that you had to move, then place your movement dice. It was a little bit weird. It was like you placed them to set up your next turn.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel instinctive. Players always wanted to just put the die on and move with it immediately. Yeah. And that there is some downsides to that, and you kind of unlock the downsides to that. As you go through the game, it gives you an option. You're like, oh, maybe I don't want to use it immediately on this turn, for various reasons in the strategy. But that was one of the ways we streamlined the game after Essen. And another way was I used to have these tokens to track your actions as an octopus. You flip them over to say, I've done my first action and my second action, and it was a bit clunky. And another playtester said, have you thought about just having slots on your board where you play the cards to? And once we unlocked that as well, it was just user interface tweak, but it made it so much more simple on your turn. You just, boom, you play a card, and boom, you play another card, and you're off.
So that was Essen 2022, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So you were talking about how busy you were and you got a lot of attention. You were telling us a story, and we'd love for you to share it with our listeners. You were telling us more about Essen this year, which was just a few weeks ago, right? Tell us about your experience at Essen.
Yeah, absolutely. So fortunately, as I live in Belgium, Essen is just a 2.5-hour drive for me. So we, for the last, we've been 6 or 7 times since I moved to Belgium. I've been going to Essen first as a punter, and then last year as a designer, and same again this year. But I'm also a teacher, and so I couldn't go Thursday, Friday because I was at work. So we drove there early Saturday morning, and the plan was for me to just be on the booth with Wonderbowl, demoing demoing Kelp and showing it off because the Kickstarter's coming up and we wanted to get in some buzz and some excitement. So Saturday morning, I showed up at the booth and it was just breathless the entire time. We were, fortunately, we were in hall three. We were really close to the Dice Tower, which is, I was fortunate enough to meet Z and Mike from the Dice Tower and chat to them a bit about Kelp, and just having that being in that area and also having traffic that heading towards them, but also the other big booths. We were just packed the entire time with people wanting to demo the game and give it a try before it goes live on Kickstarter. And so, yeah, your meeple on the ground, John. We connected beforehand. I listened to that podcast, and when before going to Essen, and I connected with him on Instagram. And I said, "Hey, I'd love to see you there." And I listened to the show, and it was just so busy. I saw him a couple of times. He'd see me. There'd be a crowd of people kind of close to the booth. I'd be explaining the rules or demoing the game or something. And we'd make eye contact and he'd kind of give me a wink to say, I'll swing back in a little bit. And he did. He really kept to his word. He swung by a couple of times, but every time I was busy and we just never got to connect, unfortunately. But fortunately, in other ways, I was busy with good things.
And awesome. So the Kickstarter is on the... So it's Tuesday the 7th of November, so same day this goes out live. Ready to go?
Yeah, I mean, Wonderbow have done an amazing job. I've been fortunate to see the progress as it's been going along with the manufacturing and the deluxe version, and obviously I've prepared some extra things, and there's an expansion going to be on there as well, so there's everything's kind of ducks in a row. And as of right now, we've got following the Kickstarter page, we've got over 4,500 people following the page. So it's amazing. Looking promising for a good launch on Tuesday.
And you did I think I'd seen on the socials kind of like a pre-order access to New Pursuits, is it an expansion that people paid paid a dollar for, which they could get a refund off their pledge? If they're basically, how's that gone?
Yeah, so that was a strategy that Wonderbow used, because being they're a relatively new publisher, this is their second game, and although they've got a lot of experience in marketing and in advertising and in also in board games as players, and they don't have a huge following yet as a publisher, mm-hmm. so. I know it's also a massive investment to do a Kickstarter, mm-hmm. much more so now in these years, competing with huge projects. And it is, it would have been five or even 3 years ago, you could have gone with a little bit less prepared, but they had to be really well prepared, which costs mm-hmm. a lot of money. So they used this to gauge interest and to get people excited before the campaign, reward people who are going to pledge and give them a kind of, if they're supporting the project early, to kind of give them a reward, but also to really help them gauge, well, how big is this going to be? How much time and money should we invest in this? And so, yeah, they offered on the website on kelpgame.com. If you were an early supporter of the project, you could get this expansion for basically added to your pledge for free if you pledge. It is still available, so anybody who's hearing this now and is like, oh, I can't get that now. No, you still can. It's just going to be a little bit more money, but not a huge amount. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the ways in which they were able to reward early backers, but not deny anybody content. And that mm-hmm. was really
important. Yes, it's not exclusive. It's good.
It's available.
How much, how much of a hand have you had in some of the developments in the deluxe version?
Not a ton really, because a lot of the deluxe is just cosmetic, but they didn't want to deny anybody who can't make that extra reach content, you know, like it is a little bit more money, but it's, so the deluxe is absolutely just cosmetic upgrades, and there's an expansion included, there's a new pursuits as you said, but there's also another expansion, Brilliant Behaviors, and those are add-ons. They wanted them kept out of the deluxe to make sure that everybody has access to them. But I tell you, going along in the last couple of months, seeing the like early bits of artwork and seeing there's a miniature for the octopus, which just holds their hand size token, and you can use it to track when you draw cards, you can actually use it to track that you've drawn cards. You can move it around.
Yeah, yeah.
but it's this just really cool little extra and things. And when I saw that for the first time, I was just I was so excited.
it's pretty amazing. The octopus miniature is pretty fancy. I like the addition of translucent dice. It definitely gives that underwater feel. But I wanted to ask you about the shark miniature. So yes. I got to play test it, and they used the Lego shark, right?
Okay.
But now you're going to get this fancy miniature, and I have to say, I kind of want the Lego shark.
Sure. And a lot of people have said that, and I totally get it. That, you know, interestingly, that Lego shark, the first one that I used is from when I was a kid. Like, it's my 5-year-old me's Lego shark. And I just was making the game, and I was like, what am I going to use as a miniature for the shark in the game? And I was like, I got a Lego shark, that'll work. Yeah. And so, it worked perfectly through my playtest. And when they picked it up and they sent out review copies, it's incredibly expensive to produce individual miniatures without the manufacturing. So instead of making multiple miniatures, they just made one for the demo, for the video and things like that. And they sent out the rest of the prototypes with Lego sharks.
Lego sharks.
But there's a couple of reasons. Obviously, it's Lego, and so there's some licensing things there that are probably tricky. But also, it's the wrong shark. It's who knows what the Lego shark is. It's probably like a great white.
That's a fair point, right?
But the pajama shark is a lot smaller. It's more like a meter and a half as a Lego shark, as a pajama shark. It's more like a dogfish or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it needs to be small. It needs to be small to be able to navigate the kelp forest where this octopus and the shark live. So the octopus isn't at risk of any bigger sharks than that, because they just can't get inside the kelp forest safely. Okay. So, yeah, but that said, you can play with a Lego shark. You could
just open the box. With the I guess keeping to I guess art and art, the artist for the game is Weberson Santiago, who's, I think it's Coup and Bloody Inner Games, which I recognize. How did you get tied up with him?
About this time last year, once the game was signed, they knew they had to get an artist pretty quickly, because artists need time to plan out there. They need time to make the work. And so we made a short list of people, each of us. There's two people in the company, Wonderbow, Laya and Zunka. And together, the three of us, we made a short list each of artists that we would want to get. And Weberson was really high on the list for all of us.
Right.
And I mean, I was just thinking, well, you know, we'll probably get someone like Weberson. We probably won't get Weberson himself. But they reached out to him, and he'd just come off the back of doing Sail, which has got a lot of buzz recently. I think Tom Vassell said it was one of the best covers he's ever seen on a board game. And a lot of hype on that cover and that artwork. So he had kind of the sea theme in his pen, if you like. And he really liked the idea of an octopus and a shark, and he liked the concept for the game, and he thought he could do a good job with it, and he has done an absolutely amazing job. So, the moment they sent through the roughs, he sent through the roughs for the cover, and I got to see that kind of forced perspective of the octopus really close up and the shark in the background swimming by. It was so exciting.
Amazing. Yeah, because I mean, as soon as I saw the artwork, you kind of recognize the style.
Yeah.
And the box cover, I mean, the board itself and the components I've seen, it's looks for a great game. What games inspire you to play? So you just go, I guess, to wrap up the show, you started playing again in 2012 when you moved to Belgium. What games hit your games table?
Early on, I was into Small World, Cyclades, big kind of four-player games, and I still enjoy those, and I still got time and place for them, but I really found a love for two-player games. And obviously that led into Kelp, but Android Netrunner is one of my favorites. I only play it casually. I've never played it competitively. I don't own a ton, and now it's dead. I'm kind of happy with my small collection, but I love the mind games of that. I love, me and my wife play games like Splendor Duel and Jaipur and Mr. Jack. And I love those, you know, also a little bit lighter, easier to get into couples games. And another one I recommend all the time as a two-player game is Shanghaian, which nobody's ever heard of. It needs a reprint because it really doesn't look good. It came out quite a few years ago from Michael Kiesling. But it is like it's like Hanamakoji, if you know Hanamakoji. It's like a two-player knife fight in a phone booth, but it's with dice. You're rolling dice and placing them with this clever twist of the way that you score cards. And although it looks like garbage, let's just hope, hope in the next few years it's going to come out with a reprint because it's really good.
Awesome.
Okay, I'll just written that down. And Mr. Jack is one of the games that help reminded me of that, a little bit about that hide and seek and trying to position yourself in the right, you know, the right place to be in the right spot to find Jack. So do you want to remind us quickly then of the live date, any other information you want to share before we close the show?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're listening to this in the future and it's sometime in the month after November 7th, then it's probably live on Kickstarter right now. So you just go there and search Kelp. If it's further in the future than that and you're a bit behind on your podcast list, well, you shouldn't be. You should be putting this first, for one thing. But if you are, then you can go to kelpgame.com and that would have all the information. So kelpgame.com. And yeah, I hope if you do check it out, you could follow me on Instagram at Carl E. Robinson. No, actually, that's my Twitter handle. My Instagram is Carl Crusoe, like Robinson Crusoe. And hit me up on Instagram, share some pictures, let me know what you thought of it. And I'd love to hear from listeners if they gave it a try at some point in the future.
Awesome. I can't
wait. Fantastic.
Well, yeah, I mean, both of us wish you the best of luck.
Yes.
The 7th, obviously, this will be live at some point that day in the morning.
Right.
And then we will put some socials out and posts and we'll just cross our fingers for a successful campaign. Mm.
I can't wait to re-dive into Kelp because that's going to be great. So
nice.
Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, guys. Really, thank you for the time this evening and for having me on. And I really appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please subscribe. And as always, we love to hear your thoughts and ideas. So make sure to leave those in the comments. And don't forget, you can also chat with us both on Instagram @meeple2meeple.